Last two lectures, as you've seen, I've had a very definite thesis for, and there was a very definite line I wanted to push. This lecture is rather different in that I don't have anything like such a definite line. I rather have a set of issues which I think are interesting and problematic, and I would like to think more about, and interestingly, philosophers have not thought a great deal about, I think, or at least they may well have done, and I've missed the literature, in which case I look forward not only to discussion from you, but also correction from you. To show me what I should have been reading. What I want to do is to talk about illness and attitude. And this is partly motivated by... I'm making rustling noises. It's not... I could just switch it off, look. But I've got to, haven't I? Because it's being recorded.
Well, the recorder is there, but...
That's the recorder?
Maybe if we...
All right, let's try that. Better? Good. I mean, I can just shout otherwise. Yeah? Good. Okay. All right, let's keep going. All right, so I really started thinking about this stuff when I was thinking about more about addiction. So I talked at some length last time about addiction. And one of the interesting things is that if you look at classical civilizations, although there's plenty of talk of drunkenness, and worse than that, of people being drunkards, the idea of a drunkard in classical civilization is just of somebody who likes their drink too much, right? It's not of someone who is addicted in anything like the contemporary sense of addiction. And then as you see people worry more about alcohol during the 17th, 18th centuries, you do get a rather more focused concern about alcohol, but it tends to be focused, as I mentioned last lecture, more on the particular kinds of alcohol that people are drinking and on the the poor quality of those for their life than it does on any real notion of addiction. So I mentioned Gin Lane and the contrast between Gin Lane, which shows, you know, the mother dropping her baby over the edge and the pawn shop taking in people's money, and Beer Street, which Hogarth also did, which shows the pawn shop out of business, the sign is swinging broken, and the woman's holding the baby lovingly, and so on and so forth. So the concern there was a concern about certain forms of alcohol being bad for you, but not again with any real notion of addiction. And if you look at the later work, so Benjamin Rush is often seen as the sort of originator of something closer to an addictive model. But in his first work, this is Effects of Ardent Spirits, which as far as I can see was first published in 1790, he does worry there about spirits, right? But he contrasts spirits with cider and beer, which again he thinks of as wholesome things. He thinks spirits are just bad for you. And he thinks if you're really in trouble and you've got pain, I've got the quotation here, the preparations of opium are much more safe, he says. So the recommendation is that you take opium rather than these bad spirits. So again, no notion really of anything approaching addiction. But then a little bit later, so 1812, he's got this book, Diseases of the Mind. And there you get a glimmer of something that looks much more like the addictive model, which then comes forward later. So he says, the use of strong drink is at first the effect of free agency. And then from habit, it takes place from necessity. So you've got that notion of addiction working as necessitation. And that really gets going a little bit later. So in Magnus Huss's work, Scandinavian, you get the coinage of the notion of alcoholism. And then you get this idea that what's happened with alcohol is not simply that there are bad effects of alcohol on the body brought about because someone likes the alcohol too much and keeps drinking it, but that the effect of alcohol is to compromise the autonomy of the agent so that they start drinking from necessity and not from a free choice in some way. So that's very late, right? That's mid-19th century that really gets going. And then you find it getting going very rapidly. So late 19th century, that starts generalizing, and then you start getting that applied to opium and to other things, which again were seen as perhaps bad for you, but not seen as addictive in the early discussions of them. So that's sort of culturally interesting, right? You might think, well, they just hadn't discovered something about these things, which I think is true. They hadn't discovered the kind of addictive qualities that I was talking about on Tuesday. But it also means that people who were addicted were not thinking of themselves as addicted in that way, right? That conception, it seems, probably wasn't there for the sufferers because, well, it just hadn't been articulated. So they didn't have a full understanding of what it is, what it was that was happening to them. So the issue I started getting interested in was the issue of what effect does it have on a subject once they start thinking of themselves under that kind of category, thinking of themselves as an addict, rather than thinking of themselves as just someone who likes drinking too much. Now, there's interestingly little research done on that. You would have thought there would have been a lot done. But there is research in similar areas. So there's lots of research on what's become known as self-efficacy. Self-efficacy is not how efficient you are, it's how efficient you believe you are at doing something and what impact that has on your likelihood to do it. And of course, once you put it like that, it's not really terribly surprising. I mean, basically the finding is if people think they can't do something, they're very reluctant to try to do it. Well, of course, but that's important. And that seems to come out in lots of different cases. So just to mention one other area which I found interesting here, you might know there's been some experimental work looking at what happens as you change people's conception of free will on their behavior. So clearly doing something wrong again, apologies for that. So the basic finding, or at least the way it was reported, was that once you get people to believe in determinism rather than in free will, they do morally bad things. So one of the findings here was that they're more like, if you give them some readings on determinism first, right, people are apparently very, very prone to just form their beliefs as a result of reading a passage like this, and then you see whether or not they'll cheat in an exam, they're much more likely to cheat in the exam if they've just read the determinism stuff than if they've read something that stresses agency and free will and so on. So the thought was, well, maybe that's because people are deep down incompatibilists. Right? So as soon as they think that there's no such thing as the determinism's true, they must think there's no such thing as free will. Therefore, they think morality's out. Therefore, they think they might as well cheat. Right? I suspect that's not right. And I think one of the studies really made it fairly clear that that wasn't right. So one of the studies involved afterwards not seeing whether people would cheat or not, but seeing whether or not people would be careful in the allocation of foodstuffs to people who'd given a preference not to have chili. Right, it's rather strange task, you might think. But anyway, this was the task. So you're allocating menus to subjects, and they have put their preferences, and they've said things like, I don't like chili, please don't give me anything hot. And what you want to see is whether or not the people still give them chili. Well, the finding was, if they've read the determinism stuff, they're much more likely to give them chili than they are if they've read the kind of autonomy-enhancing texts beforehand. So when I first read this thing, in the context of these other ones, thinking of it in terms of the idea that it was undermining of morality, the hypothesis you have for that is that these people are just itching to give people chili, right, when they don't want it, and they feel kind of constrained by morality, and they think, you know, oh, darn it, you know, I'm not allowed to do it because that would be a bad thing to do. And then you give them this determinism text, and they change their minds. That struck me as an extremely implausible interpretation. And I think a much more plausible interpretation of this, which brings us back to the self-efficacy thing, is that when you give people the deterministic texts, it's not that they start thinking through incompatibilist ways, it's that they start thinking fatalistically. That is, they start thinking, oh, nothing I think will make any difference. So they start not caring. They start not trying to do things. So I think there is some evidence there of an impact on moral behavior, but it's moral behavior through a much more direct thing, the thought that deliberation isn't going to change the things you're going to do. Okay, so one thing you might expect to have with addiction is that as people come to think of themselves as addicted, and insofar as they come to understand that as undermining their agency, you might find some undermining of their tendency to struggle against that addiction. As I say, there isn't good empirical literature on that directly. But that's a very plausible thing to assume would happen, given the findings that we have elsewhere. Okay, so that made me very broadly interested in how to think about the relationship of people's attitudes towards their illness, or, you know, the situation in which they find themselves. It's not obvious we should think of addiction as an illness. But the situations in which they find themselves, how that relates to the presentation of the symptoms and their likelihood of getting out of them. Which led me to start thinking about the most extreme versions of this, or the, you know, what you might think of as the sort of cleanest versions, which are psychosomatic illnesses. That is, illnesses which, thought of as a certain way, are merely a manifestation of the attitudes that the agents have. So the main thing I want to do today is to talk about the psychosomatic illnesses, and to try and get some understanding of the way those illnesses are working. And then I want to come back at the end to think a bit more broadly about how we think about illness in general in the light of the ways we think about that. But as I say, this is not, I don't have a, you know, a very definite thesis here so much as an attempt to explore what I find an interesting and difficult area. Okay, so let's say something about psychosomatic illness. I was partly stimulated to read more about this reading Suzanne O'Sullivan's book, All in the Head. Not a great title, I think, for the book, but a good book, a book I recommend by a neurologist who works with people coming into neurology, her neurology clinic, many of whom she finds are suffering from illnesses which we might intuitively class as psychosomatic. So let's say a little bit about why she comes to that finding and what those sorts of illnesses are. So the classic examples for this, the ones especially that she deals with a lot, are things like fits. That is, something that looks like an epileptic fit to begin with. And in fact, this might be from someone who has been suffering from epileptic fits and is now on anti-epileptic medication, and they still are convulsing in ways that look like an epileptic fit. And O'Sullivan says that anything up to a third of the cases she gets of people who are exhibiting this behavior, when you do an EEG scan on them, you find they are not exhibiting anything like classic convulsive brain states. And then if you give them anticonvulsant medications, those medications typically are not very effective with them, unlike their efficacy for people who are on the EEG revealing standard epileptic symptoms. Okay, there's one case. Second case, blindness. Epizelus is the first recorded case of this in Herodotus' histories. You have this case of someone in, I can't remember which great Greek battle he was in. He was overcome by some huge figure who loomed up behind him, and he was struck blind, although there was nothing had happened to his eyes, and he remained blind for the rest of his life. Blindness as a function of something that looks to be psychosomatic is unusual, but it is there. And the typical diagnostic for it is that you ask people to identify things, and you find they actually do worse than chance on the things you're looking at, on the things they're looking at. Right? So if they were blind, they would be at chance. They must in some way be registering what's going on there. But they are clearly not faking it. They are genuinely taking themselves to be blind. There's something genuinely going wrong there. But if you scan them, you can find nothing wrong, not just with the visual cortices, but with any other part of the brain. It used to be called hysterical blindness. People would now normally refer to it as conversion disorder. We'll talk about the terminology in a minute. Paralysis, weakness. Similar kind of thing. People present with weakness or paralysis in one foot. The typical diagnostic for this one is what's called the Hoover maneuver, or the Hoover sign, named after a doctor who realized this. So if you have someone presenting in this way, you ask them to move one of their legs. If it's the good leg, they can lift it up. They're lying on their back, they can lift it up. If it's their bad leg, they can't lift it up. You ask them to do this while cupping, well, the doctor cups their hand under the opposing ankle. If it's standard paralysis, I don't want to say genuine paralysis, because I think these are all cases of genuine paralysis, but if it's the standard organic paralysis, as it's sometimes described, when you ask them to lift the opposing leg, the one they can lift, you won't feel downward movement in the paralyzed leg, because they can't do anything with that. If, on the other hand, it's a conversion disorder, you'll find downward pressure on the opposing leg, because it's much easier when you lift one leg to push down with the other leg. So if you can do that, that's what you tend to do. Okay, so these, as you see, are all cases where you've actually got some evidence that what's going on here is strange in some way. Exactly what way, I'm just leaving open for now. And then we've got the contentious cases. The contentious cases are contentious because there is nothing like the evidence to show that they are psychosomatic in this way. The evidence for thinking they're psychosomatic is just there isn't evidence for thinking of them in another way. So these cases are extremely contentious, and I'm not going to spend very much time talking about them. But chronic fatigue syndrome, a lot of psychiatrists are alleging it's a psychosomatic illness. A lot of people are saying that's completely wrong. There was a major study done in the UK recently that was supposed to get to the bottom of some of this, at least get to the bottom of whether moderate exercise was beneficial. It failed to do so, partly because the criteria for the experiment were changed midway through the experiment, you know, exactly what you don't normally do in an experiment. And so the people on one side think that didn't matter, and the people on the other side think that's completely invalidated the whole experiment. So let me just say that's contentious. Lyme disease is another one. Chronic Lyme disease, that is symptoms persisting after an initial presentation of Lyme disease. Again, there's a split. There's a split in the medical opinion here as between those people who think this is psychosomatic and those who don't. One important thing to say here, and this has already been heralded in what I just said about epilepsy, is that it's very easy here to think that, well, either the patient is presenting in one way or the other. But very many of those cases of fits which look not to be epileptic, as I said, come from people who have a prior history of genuine EEG-signaled epilepsy. So you get the presentation of symptoms combined between different episodes in the same patient. So it is an extremely tricky thing trying to pull these apart in very many of the cases. Okay, those are the cases. Let me just talk a little bit about the terminology here, because I think the terminology is interesting and indicative of certain ways of thinking about this. The blindness, it used to be called hysterical blindness. That was the standard term for it. As hysteria, as an illness, has generally receded from sort of received medical terminology, so the notion of, for good reason, so the notion of hysterical blindness has given way to the idea of a conversion disorder there. But conversion disorder, this is basically psychoanalytic terminology, right? The idea of the conversion disorder there is that you have a psychological problem that is now being converted into a physiological presentation. That's the sort of classic psychoanalytic way of thinking about it. Indeed, it is the case that people presenting with psychosomatic illnesses, with conversion illnesses, very often do have either depression or other kinds of personality disorder, or they might have a history of childhood abuse or something like that. So there are certainly correlations there. But there's more to this term, at least there's more to the history of this term than just thinking that there's some kind of causal influence there, or there's some vulnerability given by having these psychiatric or other problematic conditions. And that is the idea that there is something very agential in the way the patient presents. Not in terms of the patient explicitly intending to do these things, but in the sense of the person in some way, there being some part to the person that is unconsciously intending to present the symptoms in these sorts of ways. And that's something which I want to think a little bit more about in just a minute. But let's just put that to one side for now. Let's think about how to characterize psychosomatic illness first, because it's not... This is somewhere where I thought there would be a big philosophical literature. There doesn't seem to be a huge one. So Galen says about someone, "I was convinced that the woman was not affected by some bodily disease, but rather some emotional trouble grieved her." This is often taken to be the first medical presentation of a psychosomatic illness. This is the case, actually, of a woman who's in love with someone who comes and she shows her certain symptoms in the presence of her lover and not at other times. Okay, so there's a contrast, look, between bodily disease and an emotional trouble. Suzanne O'Sullivan, in the book that I mentioned earlier, says that the psychosomatic things she's talking about are physical symptoms that occur for psychological reasons. Okay, now both of these involve, well, in this case, a distinction between the physical and the psychological. Now, if you are at all materialist in your tendency, that is not going to be a good way of thinking about it, right? There is a dualism which underlies a lot of the thinking here. So in many of the discussions, you find that organic illnesses, as they're sometimes called, that is not the psychosomatic ones, they're organic in the sense that they're kind of bodily and they involve physical processes, whereas the psychosomatic ones involve psychological processes. Well, fine if you think psychological processes are not bodily physical processes. But if they are bodily physical processes, we do not yet have any way of telling these apart. What if you look elsewhere? What if you look to DSM, which is the sort of classic place you might look? I mean, interestingly, DSM is a bit of a mess on psychosomatic symptoms and presentations. It's changed from DSM-4 to DSM-5. So in DSM-4, you have somatoform disorder, which is many psychosomatic symptoms presenting in the same patient. So they might both be having blindness and paralysis and fits. You had to have actually a set from various different categories. And conversion disorder, the kinds I was talking about, they're both defined negatively. They're both defined basically in terms of having medically unexplained symptoms. But look, medically unexplained symptoms, either that's a technical term that doesn't mean what you would think it would mean, or it's a hopeless term to be using here, right? I mean, you don't want to think that AIDS sufferers, before HIV was discovered, were presenting with psychosomatic symptoms, even though they were medically unexplained. And in the cases I was talking about, like the blindness and the paralysis and so on, you've actually got reasons for thinking that they're not medically unexplained. I mean, we don't have a full medical explanation, but we've got some thought that they're presenting in a particular sort of way, which rules out the visual a flaw in the visual system in the case of blindness and so on. So that's not going to do the work, I think. And in DSM-5, we move to something very different, which is that people talk about somatic symptoms, but now somatic symptoms somatic symptom disorder. But there the thought is just basically that you are too worried about the symptoms you have, given the kind of symptoms they are. Right. So there was much worry when DSM-5 came out. A lot of psychiatrists were worried that this would result in lots and lots of people being diagnosed with somatoform disorder, because it's just the case that people think, you know, you're too more worried than you should be about whatever it is that's gone wrong with you. In fact, that hasn't resulted in such a huge outbreak of diagnoses, but largely because it looks as though most psychiatrists are just ignoring this category in DSM-5 and it's not doing any work. So we can't really look to DSM for help here. So what can we say if we just think about it? Well, I think the natural thing to say about this is that psychosomatic complaints involve non-psychological symptoms, though even that is not an easy thing to work out quite what you mean by that, but maybe we can do it just by sort of cases, like paralysis or blindness, but non-psychological symptoms that are there at least partly as a result of the attitudes, perhaps the psychological attitudes, that the subject has. Right? So a classic case would be if you do something because you believe something about those symptoms or something about yourself in a certain way. Now, of course, the risk here, that seems to me to capture nicely what you want to think about the things like the conversion disorders, that something that's happening there is being mediated via the attitude of the subject. But of course, once you cast your net that widely, you get a whole load of other things in with it. Right? So, you know, I talked about addiction. Well, if you believe you're addicted and as a result of that you keep drinking, does that mean it's now become a psychosomatic illness? Or suppose, you know, I hurt my back and I've been told that if you hurt your back, a good thing to do is to lie very still. Or maybe, you know, everyone knows that's been discredited, but I hurt my back and I think, well, whenever I do any exercise, it really doesn't feel good. So I become very cautious about doing exercise, and as a result of failing to do any exercise, my back goes into more spasm than it would have done beforehand. It stiffens up and whatever. That now looks like becoming a psychosomatic illness on this way of thinking. Okay, so what could you say? How could you narrow the class in a way to stop these things that intuitively we might not want to be psychosomatic to come in? Well, one thing you could try, there are two ways I've thought you might try and do this. One way, you might try and focus on the causal connection. And you might want to say, look, in a true psychosomatic illness, the connection between the attitude and the presentation has to be immediate, right? It mustn't be mediated via some other kind of activity or some other kind of behavior. So, you know, if you have to fail to do exercise, that's not going to count. But it's not clear to me this will do the work. Firstly, it doesn't obviously rule out the right cases, so it's not obvious that's the right thing to say in the addictive case. Secondly, we need to know what's happening in the cases of conversion blindness, say. And it could well be that what happens there is that there are a number of steps. It's just they're not external steps, they're internal steps. So I think an immediacy thing won't work. Second thing you might try to say is, well, let's focus on the attitude. It has to be a certain sort of attitude with a certain sort of content. Something like, perhaps, some belief that one's ill or something like that. Well, certainly that, again, gets the conversion disorders all right, but it might well get the addiction case, at least depending on how much people are buying the disease model of addiction when they think of themselves as within that. So I can't really see a good way of defining the psychosomatic here. And to begin with, I was thinking that was a flaw. And the more I thought about it, I thought that was actually exactly the right thing to think here. Because I think one of the problems here is that by focusing on these fairly extreme cases, we are thinking there might be a kind of disease or a kind of illness which is very different to the normal stuff. And when you read the O'Sullivan book, at least to me, that was my first thought, was, wow, you know, the world is stranger, more bizarre than I thought. And increasingly, I think, no, this is just a far end of a continuum which we're all on all the time. Right? That is, everybody thinks that illness is massively influenced by the attitudes that people have. You know, witness the back case. Or witness, you talk to doctors in this area, witness things like a whole range of cases. So let me just talk through some of the different things that might show this in some ways. So firstly, it looks like there are lots of cases of something like motivated belief which give rise to strange behaviours on people, or to fairly ordinary behaviours on the part of people, By motivated belief, I mean a belief that someone has because they think that believing that thing would benefit them in a certain way. So the classic examples here are cognitive dissonance phenomena. So let me just give you an outline of that. You know, this is seen to be absolutely standard for normal psychologies. So, for instance, a classic case of this. You get subjects into a laboratory and you ask them to put their hands into iced water for a couple of minutes. You can try this at home. It's a really, really nasty thing to do. And that's why they ask people to do it, because it's not actually damaging, but it's really nasty. And then at the end of having asked them to do that, you say, you divide them into two groups, and to one group you say, look, this is really important, the experiment we're doing. You know, you've put false electrodes all over them and they think they're in some fancy experiment, and that's why they're holding their hands in the cold water. And to one group you say, this is a really important medical experiment we're doing. We've got to get it right. So I'm sorry it was so unpleasant putting your hand into the cold water, but we're going to ask you to do it again. Okay. Second group, you say, we've got all the results we need, but I'm afraid our funding body insists that we repeat every experiment. So I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you to put your hand into the cold water again, and you get them to do it. And then afterwards, you ask them to rank on a pain scale just how much pain was generated by putting your hand into the iced water. If you ask people in advance who would say it hurt more, most people predict that it's the people who... I let you predict, right? I won't ask you, but just have a little think. Who would you think? Most people predict that it's the people who think that the funding body is requiring them to do it a second time, right? Because you think they'd be pissed off about all this, and they've really... It's actually the other way around. Strongly the other way around. Why is it the other way around? Well, because people really don't like to think of themselves as suckers. At least that's a sort of rather crude way of thinking of it, but they do not like to think of themselves as being made to do things that they really don't want to do. And now you're in a very constrained environment. How can you minimize how much of a sucker you are? Well, the only parameter by which you can change this at this point is by reducing your belief in how much the thing hurt. Right? If it didn't hurt very much, then that was trivial, so it didn't matter, so you're less. That kind of behavior you find across the board. So insofar as you might think that psychosomatic behavior involves that kind of thing, it would be commonplace. Does it? Well, that's a question I want to look at in just a minute. Second set of cases, psychiatric illnesses manifest themselves in different ways in different times. We've got enough good anthropology and history to know that that's the case. It depends on quite which symptoms you're looking at. So a lot of people think anorexia was like that, that there wasn't very much anorexia and then there was very much more. In fact, if you look at the figures for anorexia, it's not so clear. But bulimia does look to be a presentation which was unusual and then in a short space of time became very, very much more commonplace. What's happening with bulimia? Well, it seems most likely that what you've got there is a behavior which people are, to some degree, learning from other people. That's not to say they're doing it for no reason. It's not to say bulimia is not a genuine issue in any way, but it's to say that the presentation of the symptoms there is conditioned by what? Well, again, by the attitudes of the person there. That is, how they think that someone presents in those ways. Another example, you're probably familiar with this, schizophrenia. There are certain things which present, you know, fairly constant. There's debate about things like catatonia. So there was a period where it looked as though catatonic symptoms, that is where people are kind of in something approaching paralysis, was going out. It's a bit of debate about that. Maybe it's come back in again. Maybe the figures were not great there. But if you look at the more superficial presentations, you certainly find those change. So a graduate student colleague of mine when I was Princeton, who's now at McGill, has some lovely work with his brother, he's a philosopher, his brother's a psychiatrist, where his brother in New York was finding people presenting with the belief that they were in a soap opera. Right. This had not, he hadn't had this before. Suddenly there was a wave of people doing this. This was after they'd seen this movie, the title of which I always forget. Someone enlighten me. The Truman Show, thank you. So he calls it Truman disease. And it's, you know, there's now a good little set of case studies on people presenting with Truman disease. Now, or the Truman symptoms. That, of course, again, is a symptom which is mediated here via a belief. But again, schizophrenia itself, you don't want to think of as a pure psychosomatic illness. Clearly it's not. But there are aspects to schizophrenia which meet this kind of profile. So I think rather than trying to characterize the psychosomatic, as a special thing, what we should be doing is looking to see how we should be thinking about it in terms of further features it might have. And my long-term thought is that this might help us a little bit with the stigma which has been attached both to psychosomatic conditions and to various other conditions. And maybe, you know, who knows if one could do it well enough, help a little bit in the bitterness of the disputes around the cases where people aren't sure whether they're psychosomatic or not. So let's do some of that. Let's look at some of the characterization. So firstly, let's think about whether they involve an intentional presentation. So as I said, thinking about it in terms of conversion disorder very often leads people to think that what's involved here is unconscious but nonetheless intentional activity. Right? You are unconsciously, intentionally doing something. In the same way that you might think with a lot of the cognitive dissonance stuff, you don't realize you're doing these things, but you are unconsciously but intentionally doing them. Okay, let's start making some distinctions here. Well, there are two different ways I think you might think of the intentional working here. Firstly, you might think that the person intentionally wants other people to believe that they have the illness that they have. Right, that could be one way of thinking about it. But be careful here, because there is a distinction. It's actually a distinction which has caused all kinds of problems in intentional logics to try and work out how to characterize it. But think about a spy catcher who wants to catch spies. Right? Does the spy catcher who wants to catch spies want there to be spies? Well, it's a presupposition, you might think, of catching spies, that there be spies. So you might think it's a presupposition of wanting to catch spies that you want there to be spies. Well, of course, there may be some spy catchers who genuinely want to show off how good they are at catching spies, and therefore they want there to be spies so that they can catch them. But a lot of spy catchers just don't want there to be spies at all. Contrast the person camping in their tent catching mosquitoes. Right? The ideal would be that there weren't any mosquitoes there in the first place. But if there are any mosquitoes, you better catch them. So what you want to do is to catch mosquitoes if there are some. Right? Contrast them with the grouse shooter, right? Who, if there aren't any grouse there, think that they've paid their 10,000 quid or whatever it is for nothing and are cross with the estate for failing to provide the grouse that had better be cultivated just so that these people can shoot them. So when you say, does the person want people, other people, to believe that they have the illness? Well, yes, of course, if they believe they have the illness, they want other people to believe that they have it. Just as all of us, when we have any, or at least there are a few super stoical types, right, who really don't want other people to know when they're sick. But most of us, at least if the thing is bad enough, if we have it, we want other people to know that we have it. Partly so they can treat us, partly so they can give us some slack so that we don't have to do the things we would ordinarily have to do. So if the claim is just that in presenting with psychosomatic illness, you want people to believe you've got it on the assumption that you've got an illness, then there's nothing at all special here. Okay, so what else could it be? Well, it could be that the actions that the people are doing, the symptoms, insofar as those symptoms are kind of something like action-based, are themselves intentional actions. Now, that's already tricky, I think, because take almost any illness, right? I mean, suppose you've hurt your foot and you're limping. Right. If someone, is there shooting all the limping people, you may well be able to put on a pretty good non-limp for a while in order to escape that, right? To that extent, what you've got is an intentional behavior. It's something which is to some degree under your control. So you don't, it can't be too tight a thing, because most illnesses involve ongoing behaviors which themselves have intentional aspects, right? Many of us can suppress coughing in many cases. Doesn't mean to say coughing is a straight out intentional behavior. But nonetheless, take someone having a fit, take someone being blind. The thought is, how could that not be an intentional behavior in some way? Okay, so I think what we really need here is something like a possibility proof to show us that it may well not be. So let's turn to the neuroscience insofar as we've got some here. It would be nice if there was an enormous neuroscience literature here. There isn't. The cases studied are in the dozens rather than in the thousands, which is what you would ideally want. But nonetheless, from the studies of the dozens, there are some things that are very clear. First thing that's pretty clear, if you put someone who, is exhibiting a paralysis which you can't understand any other way in a scanner, and scan them, and you put someone else in the scanner, and you say, I want you to try as hard as you can to pretend that you're paralyzed, those two people do not look alike. So it doesn't look as though these are intentional behaviors in the straight-out form, where if you tell someone to do it, that's what you get. Right? So there's already something very significant there. It's tricky, right? Because it's tricky to get people to exhibit the behavior in the right kind of way, and it could be that someone who's been doing it for a long time has got good at it in the way that when you just ask a subject to do it, they're not very good at it. But nonetheless, the prima facie evidence there suggests that this is not straight out faking behavior, and it's not even unconscious faking behavior, insofar as that faking behavior would lead the motor regions, which is what you're largely looking at, to be acting in just the same way. What else does it show? Well, it's, as I say, it's tricky. There are certainly issues of inhibition of the normal neural networks that would normally be working. And there's some evidence of there being affective, emotional stuff happening in these cases. But looking primarily at the former, there's a fair bit of evidence that shows if we take paralysis or blindness, that what you get here is something that's rather similar to the kind of phenomenon that you get with hemispatial neglect. So let me say a little bit about that. Hemispatial neglect is a symptom that people typically get after a stroke, which involves them not seeing, or in other ways neglecting, part of the visual field or the field that they would feel and so on. So for instance, if you ask them to draw what they can see in front of them, they will draw half of the field and not the other half. If you ask them what can they see, they will talk about one half and not the other half. But if you look at their visual apparatus, it doesn't seem to have been compromised. Right? What the stroke has done in most of these cases is in some way compromise the attention system. That is, I mean, in these cases there is real damage, but the damage is to how, what part of the visual field are they attending to? Okay. Now it looks as though some of this conversion disorder blindness, and likewise some of the paralysis, is very similar to that. In which case, it would be an attentional problem. Now you might say, well, if it's an attentional problem, how are they in a position to know that to go worse than chance, right, when you ask them on a visual test? Well, but people suffering from hemispatial neglect themselves often show visual awareness within the area that they think they can't see anything in. So, for instance, if you show them a house and it's on fire on the side which they're neglecting, and you ask, where in the house would you like to live? They will indicate, you know, the side not. And then if you switch it, so the fire's the other side, they'll go for the other side. So there's some awareness within the apparently neglected area of what's going on. And it looks as though it may be the same kind of thing that one gets in blindsight. That is, there may be some unconscious awareness, even though there's a failure of conscious awareness. Okay, now as I say, that is contentious. Right? There are some neuroscientists who think it's like neglect. There are some who are more skeptical about that. But at least that's shown us a model, I think, for thinking that it could well be the case that the patient isn't actually intentionally kind of not looking at the thing. What they're doing is failing to think that they can attend to that side. That's what happens in the stroke case, right? It comes back to the stuff I was talking about earlier with self-efficacy. If you think you can't do something, you don't try to do it. So the standard therapy for neglect is to take people to the edge of what they can see and then try and take them a little bit over and then go back again. And in that way, slowly increase the area which they are prepared to attend to. Okay, so, you know, we don't know. We don't have enough data. But at the very least, we shouldn't be in the business of thinking that the impact of the attitudes here needs to be an impact that takes you to a straight-out intentional behavior which looks like part of you pretending a certain thing obtains, right, unconsciously, rather than the attitude working from you thinking there's nothing you can do about this, and hence not trying to do it. All right. Sorry, I'm running a little bit short on time, but let me speed up a little bit. Okay. You might think, even if you've got that model, so that you don't think this is intentional behavior, unconsciously intentional behavior, that nonetheless this is motivated belief. And there is a substantial literature using, again, basically psychoanalytic frameworks for thinking that the psychosomatic presentations involve beliefs which are themselves motivated, right? Like the cognitive dissonance style beliefs. As I say, that's so widespread, it wouldn't be surprising. But in fact, the evidence that we've got for this is not terribly persuasive. So the discussion here typically talks in terms of primary and secondary gain. Secondary gain is the main focus here. So that is, what benefits do you get from exhibiting the psychosomatic conditions? So the things very often people say is, well, you know, they get a pension, or they get, you know, let off their job, or there are all these kind of material benefits that people get. And indeed, it does look as though people who get those benefits are more likely to continue presenting with the psychosomatic symptoms than people who don't. There's some evidence for that. From which people very readily conclude, well, this shows that there's a primary gain which itself is motivating, maybe not motivating the behavior, but motivating the belief. If only I believed this, then, you know, things would be better. As in, if only I believed this cold water didn't hurt, then I wouldn't feel such a sucker. But look, that in itself, again, we don't have good evidence there. We've got no more good evidence there, I think, than we have for believing in intelligent design. Right? What do intelligent design people say? They say, you know, we have wonderful things here because someone must have thought about them and thought about how good they'd be if only they designed them that way. Right? Whereas someone who's read their Darwin says, no, you don't have to think that. All you have to think is that if the environment rewards in the right way, certain tendencies might be prolonged which would otherwise be upended. Right. So any gain that you look at in the case of these illnesses does not have to be explained using intentional mechanisms any more than intelligent design has to be brought to explain these things. It could just be that people who seriously believe they have a certain condition, for perhaps perfectly good reasons, benefit from that, and that stops them doing the kinds of things which would lead them to reevaluate those beliefs, right? Because they're in a position which in those ways is more attractive. But it doesn't push it in the motivated belief direction, I think, at all. Okay, there's one other thing I just want to mention. I'm kind of running a bit short of time, so I'm not going to say very much about it. But there's a phenomenon that I've been very interested in the case of addiction, and that comes up in some other things, which is a notion of self-signaling. So sometimes we do things in order to find out what we're like, right? Sometimes that's a perfectly good thing to do. Right? Suppose, you know, some friend invites you for a 2-week skiing holiday in the Alps. And suppose you've never been skiing before. And you don't know whether you would like it or not. And you want to find out whether you'd like it. So maybe, you know, you book a 2-hour pass on an artificial ski slope outside Sheffield to see whether you like the phenomenon of skiing, right? Well, that's a perfectly sensible thing. You do some behavior in order to find out something about yourself, whether you like skiing or not. You know, is it this wonderful, exhilarating thing, or is it terrifying and horrible? If it's me, it's terrifying and horrible, you know, right? You're not going to do that anymore. You're not going to put any money into that thing. Okay, but you also get it in cases which look more problematic. So the classic example of this is Max Weber talking about Protestantism, in particular Calvinism. Right. So Calvin tells you that you are either one of the elect or one of the reprobate. If you're one of the elect, nothing you can do will make any difference to how you will come out, whether you'll go to heaven or not. You will go. If you're one of the reprobate, nothing you can do will make any difference. You will go to hell. So why don't people just, you know, dance and party all night? Why on earth do they lead, you know, religiously approved lives under these circumstances? In fact, some people did dance and party all night, given that Calvinist view, but not very many of them. Weber's explanation was, well, they want evidence that they're going to go to heaven. And behaving well is evidence that you're going to go to heaven. Right? But that's a terrible argument, right? It's only evidence that you're going to go to heaven if the thing you're looking for bears the right relationship to the behavior you've got here. And if that behavior is just motivated by a desire to know something good, then there's no way you can think it has the capacities needed. Now, I think actually in addiction, you do get something like self-signaling behavior happening very often. That is, people are often in the business of kind of testing themselves to see whether they can give things up. And unless, you know, things are like dieting and whatever, you get a lot of this. You get people trying things and thinking, God, that was really hard. So it's very unlikely I'm going to manage to keep off this so long. So there's no point keeping off now. So you get that kind of feedback. You also get virtuous feedback sometimes, that people think, well, that was easy enough, so I'm going to keep going with it. It could be that in psychosomatic illness you get some self-signaling behavior. That is, it could be that you get, in some cases, people trying to find out what they are like via doing behaviors which themselves are kind of constitutive of the thing, so they're not really giving them the information. But I have seen no good evidence one way or the other. But this is a topic that I would be interested in. If anyone's got any thoughts about it, I would love to know. Okay, so what should we say? Well, I think the obvious thing to say at this point is that so far as we know, someone who is presenting with psychosomatic illness here genuinely believes, not for any particularly motivated reason, but just because they've got evidence of some sense for it, that they've got a condition of blindness or whatever it is, and that as a result of that belief, they then go on to manifest the symptoms in a stronger way. Right. That is a very simple-minded way of thinking about it, but I don't see anything so far that forces us off that way of thinking about it. Now, if that's right, again, going back to the thing I said right at the beginning, it's very much like, perhaps, some of the cases where, because you've got a bad back, and you genuinely believe that acting in a certain way will make it worse, you fail to do anything. You fail to do those actions, and as a result, you make it worse. So in a way, I want to make this more mundane. And part of my reason for wanting to make it more mundane is to think that we've got ourselves into a very bad position in thinking about how to treat psychosomatic illness. So if you talk to the psychiatrists I've talked to about this, say, by the time they get someone, typically what's happened is that they've gone to a neurology ward or something like that, and the doctors have said, well, it's probably such and such, some neurological condition. And they try that on them, and that fails. And then they think, oh, it must be some more sophisticated, you know, more outlandish thing. So they try a diagnosis for that, and that fails, and then some other thing fails. And then at the end of it, they say, oh, I'm sorry. I mean, not exactly you failed by our criteria, but something very close to that. So you need to see a psychiatrist. Right. Well, understandably, people don't like that, right? I mean, you've presented with something horrible, and maybe the people aren't saying you're faking it, but at least what it sounds like is they're saying, actually, you're mad, and so you're off, then you go out. That seems like a very, very bad way of running those kinds of clinics. There is a contrasting way of doing it, and it's there in some hospitals in some areas. So if you go in presenting with type 2 diabetes, it's not that people say, okay, well, we'll do all the physical stuff first, and then when we've finished that, you know, maybe we'll send you to a psychiatrist just to make sure you don't keep stuffing yourself. That's not what people think. They say, look, you've got this really difficult condition which has to be simultaneously treated as involving both certain sorts of physical responses and the attitudes that you have to them and to other things. Right? That is, you start doing those from the beginning. So increasingly in some hospitals we have liaison psychiatry, which attempts to liaise with the other disciplines, but it's still, by and large, unless it's something like diabetes, it tends to be a second thought, right, when the other stuff has run out. So maybe what would be much better, and of course this is big hospital reorganization issues that one would have to be confronting here, is that there would be a more simultaneous interaction with the attitudes of the patient thought about by people who are good at thinking about those kinds of things. Now, at the moment, all we have are psychiatrists for doing that. But the things I've been talking about do not look terribly like most of the other mental illnesses that psychiatrists are dealing with. So it's not obvious that psychiatry should be the right discipline there, unless there's comorbidity with depression or whatever the other thing is, when, of course, you would be assuming. And that may be causally important, but you don't think the psychosomatic stuff in itself is automatically a psychiatric thing. Okay, let me broaden this out just to conclude with a much broader concern I have, and this comes back to some of the things I was talking about earlier. So we moved a few years ago from the US to back to Cambridge. And the school my daughter was thinking of going to in Cambridge MA had a huge amount of cutting amongst the kids there, to the extent that certainly amongst her friends it was sort of 1 in 3, 1 in 4, those kinds of figures. She came back to Cambridge, there was very little cutting, actually none in the school she came to. Now, it could be that in the American school there was just more pressure, or it could be that in the American school the pressure manifested in symptoms like that rather than in other things. Now, you might think, well, okay, cutting, most psychiatrists are not terribly worried about cutting. It tends not to be life-threatening. It's you know, as these things go, it's much better than someone coming with various eating disorders, which often are life-threatening. In fact, anorexia is as life-threatening as any psychiatric disorder you can present with. But if those things are in some ways being influenced by the attitudes that people have, then we desperately need to know how much that is an attitudinal effect which is driving it. And I think we don't know that terribly well. So to go back to the anorexia case, you know, the literature on this is not great. But there are some studies that suggest, there's a guy called Lee who's doing interesting stuff on this in Hong Kong, that there was very little anorexia in Hong Kong until there was one case which hit the newspapers. And when it hit the newspapers, it then turned into a big worry, with the result that anti-anorexia campaigns started in many of the schools. And his claim is that the presentation of anorexia went up hugely as soon as those campaigns had started in the schools. Now, as I say, that's one study. That's not terribly well established. But if it is true that the incidence of anorexia, an incredibly dangerous condition, is partly being changed by the attitudes of the people there, even if only a little bit, that's something that we desperately need to know about. And I think one of the difficulties here is that because of the way psychosomatic illness has been characterized as this kind of way out thing, so disconnected from other things, driven by self-interest in a certain sort of way, people are very reluctant even to think about that. And so my thought here is, insofar as you think of this as a much more normal phenomenon, maybe it will make us more relaxed about thinking about those concerns. And if those are real concerns, they certainly are things we need to be thinking more about. Okay, I'll stop there.